This fast. Take him down. Contain it. 50 dead isn't containment. Not just 50. 50 plus collateral damage.
Collateral damage. Jurgen realizes that he is potentially collateral damage.
Let them out of the valley, DuBose says. It'll be harder to impose a news blackout on whatever they do. And if we have to check every vehicle going out, we're revealing our hand to the hawk bitch. So we might as well check everyone coming in. Nail her if we can.
Maybe she's already here.
I'd bet on it, DuBose says.
Although it seems as if Minette Butterworth will at any moment charge them in a fit of savage fury. Instead, she turns and leaps up the porch steps and disappears into the house, gone in 2 seconds. Chapter 11. A faded blue sky, sun-blasted sand and rock, sparse, seared vegetation in scraggly configurations that suggested the mutant consequence of some long-ago incident involving a devastating release of deadly radiation. The land seemed to speak, seemed to say, "The boy is mine, now and forever." They were on County Highway S-22, the Salton Sea behind them, maybe 27 miles from the heart of Borrego Springs, when Jane spotted the big highway department truck parked 10 feet off the road, about 50 yards ahead of them. No pavement repairs were underway. No workers were attendant to the vehicle. "Slow down," she told Bernie, "but don't stop." As they drifted toward the truck, she saw what she expected. The lens hood of a camera in a motion detector activated video and transmitter package mounted under the bumper of the truck. Their license plate was scanned and instantly sent to whatever special operations post the Arcadians had set up in Borrego Valley. She had no concern that Enrique DeSoto had let her down this time. A check of the DMV would show that the Tiffin Allegro was registered to Albert Rudolph Neary. "Okay, up to speed." As Bernie accelerated, she said, "What's your name again?" Instead of answering simply, he elaborated.
"Well, Mama named me Albert Rudolph, and she called me Al, but I never did much like Al, even though I loved Mama. So ever since she died when I was just 17, I've gone by Rudy."
Still perched on the Euro recliner behind Jane, Luther Tillman said,
"So, where are you from, Rudy?"
"Born in Topeka. Left Kansas after Mama died. My dad passed from a heart attack when I was a baby. Came west and been here ever since. Right now I live in Carpinteria, a pretty town, a true little slice of heaven. Penny, my wife, Jesus bless her soul, she died 4 years ago. Penny loved the desert, so I spread her ashes there, like she wanted, and I come back every April to visit with her."
Jane was impressed that Bernie had changed his speech patterns and vernacular, which required a sustained, conscious effort. All that detail, where'd that come from? He smiled.
"In the wig business, a person has to be something of, you should excuse the expression, a bullshit artist."
Chapter 12. Beaumont, floating in the flux of the storm, and Egon Gottfried swimming in an ocean of data, fingers stroking the laptop keys. Sue Ann McMaster, Killeen bus station clerk, 29 years old, born in Vidor, Texas, is married to Kevin Eugene McMaster, who is the manager of a landscaping company. Sue Ann is the mother of 2 children, 8-year-old Jack and 6-year-old Nancy. Nothing in her life suggests she is connected in any way to the Hawk family. Gottfried almost misses a fact that links her not to the Hawks, but to at least another person in the chain of deceit that resulted in his being led to that desolate property where Baldwin and Penn now lie dead, assuming one believes they ever existed. Sue Ann McMaster was born Sue Ann Luckman, but following her marriage to Kevin 9 years earlier, when she applied for a revised driver's license to reflect her married name, her previous license was not in the name Luckman, but in the name Spencer. Further digging reveals that a first marriage, at the age of 17, to one Roger John Spencer of Beaumont, ended after 8 months when he was killed in a traffic accident. Spencer. The fifth name on Gottfried's list is Mary Lou Spencer, the bus station manager here in Beaumont. He needs only 5 minutes to learn that she is the mother of three, that one of her children was Roger John Spencer, the very same who died in a traffic accident 11 years ago. If Gottfried didn't understand that the world and everything in it is illusionary, he might think it unremarkable that this link between Sue Ann and Mary Lou exists. Obviously, if Mary is working in the bus business in Beaumont, and Sue is, back in the day, perhaps employed at the same station, it is the most natural thing for Roger to encounter his mother's young co-worker, be smitten by her, and eventually marry her. 2 years after Roger's death, when Sue meets Kevin McMaster and marries him and moves to Killeen, it is also logical that she would seek employment at the bus station, perhaps even arrange for a transfer from Beaumont. If you believe the world is real, intricately detailed and infinitely layered, you might expect an endless series of minor coincidences of this nature and find nothing suspicious in them. Because Gottfried is aware that the world is an exceptionally clever conceit, not as complex and deep as it seems, but merely a narrative spun by the unknown playwright for his, her, its enjoyment, he knows at once that this link between Sue and Mary is evidence of a nefarious conspiracy. In addition, he is certain that the three other names on his list are also players in an elaborate campaign of misdirection with the intention of concealing the true whereabouts of Ansel and Claire. All he needs to do is find their connections and, upon reviewing the material he gathers on them, determine which of them is most likely to know where Jane Hawke's in-laws have gone. Then, he can cut the truth out of the deceitful bastard or bitch, whichever proves to be the case. Because Gottfried enjoys backdoor access to the NSA's Utah data center and all its myriad connections across the country, he expects to wrap this up in an hour or less. A prolonged nova of lightning explodes across the day, as if the illusion of a storm sky and a universe beyond has in an instant been ripped away and the searing truth of existence revealed. The thunder, crashing close in the wake of the first flare, rocks the foundations of this world. The unknown playwright approves. The fun will soon begin. Chapter 13. Bernie slowed for a sudden backup in traffic. The vehicles in line were mostly cars and SUVs. From the high cockpit of the motorhome, Jane Hawke had a clear enough view of the obstruction to identify it. She said, "Police roadblock." As the motorhome came to a halt, she disconnected her safety harness, swiveled the co-pilot's chair, and thrust to her feet. Luther was on the move, heading toward the bedroom at the back of the Tiffin Allegro. Jane stepped past the dinette booth to a sofa that doubled as a pull-out bed opposite the fridge and cooktop.
"Give a shout, you need help,"
said Bernie. "I can take care of this. You just be the best Albert Rudolph Neary you can be." The sofa bed was on a platform that Enrique DeSoto had raised from 13 inches to 15. He had taken the folding bed and its mechanism out of the platform so that it was now hollow. In its original condition, thick sofa cushions had to be removed to access the pull-out bed and unfold it. Now that it had been remade, the seat cushions were glued to a slab of inch-thick particle board, the edge of which was concealed with welting. When she pushed on the welted edge of the particle board, she released a pressure latch that freed the entire slab to which the pillows were glued. It glided forward on hidden roller tracks, exposing the hiding place beneath. Jane stepped over the cushions and sat in the cavity. She stretched out flat on her back, head against one side wall of the sofa, feet against the other. In the bedroom, in similar fashion, Luther would be secreting himself within the larger platform of the queen-sized bed. the box springs having been removed by Enrique and replaced by particle board that supported the mattress. With one hand, Jane slid the pillowed platform shut, and the pressure latch clicked. She would be able to release the latch from this position when the time came to climb out. In the confining darkness, she listened to the low rumble of the engine as, in fits and starts, the vehicle moved forward toward the roadblock. If the motorhome had been transporting illegal drugs, and if this had been a border crossing with experienced DEA agents, they would have found the secret stashes in about 3 minutes, even without the assistance of dogs. But the men manning the roadblock were FBI or Homeland Security or maybe NSA, not drug enforcement types, and they were probably not familiar with human trafficking techniques either. With Bernie Rigowitz behind the wheel, the least likely getaway driver in the annals of crime, any search of the Tiffin Allegro was likely to be perfunctory. Chapter 14. Having taken refuge in the driver's seat of her Buick, doors locked and engine running, Mrs. Attlee stares out at Carter Jurgen and the others as though she is in a deep-sea submersible, watching the strange marine creatures in an oceanic crevasse as they go about their watery business, unaware that they are about to be torn apart and swallowed by some approaching leviathan. Perhaps because they are baffled and frightened by the behavior of the naked, bloody Minette, the two deputies acquiesce to Radley DeBose's assumption of authority. As directed, Deputy Utley goes to the northeast corner of the house, from which he can see two sides of the residence, and Deputy Parkwood goes to the southwest corner to maintain surveillance of the other two sides. They will sound an alarm if the woman attempts to flee the house by door or window. A de Havilland DHC-6 Twin Otter passes overhead, ceaselessly netting transmissions from those carrier waves that are assigned to disposable cell phones, hoping Jane Hawk will make a call, allowing them to get a fix on her. In this debilitating heat, the airplane's turboprop engines sound like the lazy droning of a giant bumblebee. DeBose intends to go into the house through the front door. He expects Jurgen to go with him.
"We should wait for backup," Jurgen counsels as he proceeds across the yard with the big man. "There is no backup, my friend. Backup is busy manning those roadblocks and tracking zombies."
"Zombies? What are you talking about, zombies?"
"Zombies like Minette Butterworth."
As DeBose reaches the porch steps, Jurgen halts short of them. The sun is a torch. The air is as dry as that in a blast furnace. Each inhalation sears his throat.
"She's not a zombie.
She's fallen through the forbidden door. Psychological retrogression, like you said. Reptile consciousness." Turning to Jurgen, DeBose speaks with a degree of impatience meant to shame Jurgen for being thick-headed.
"If she has any memory of her life to date, it's minimal. If there's a natural law that tells us right from wrong, she's no longer aware of it. She has no Tao, no conscience, no inhibitions, maybe not even any fear. She lives entirely for pleasure, and one of her greatest pleasures is the thrill of violence. She is fearless of consequences because she no longer has the intellectual capacity to imagine what they might be, or even that there are such things as consequences. To her, the world is a rat's warren, and she's a serpent with no other purpose than to hunt. Like a snake, she'll kill to eat and defend herself, but unlike a snake, she'll also kill in an orgasmic frenzy just for the excitement of it, for the rush of emotion, because it makes her clitoris throb like nothing else can. In that viperous brain of hers, in that black hole of collapsed psychology, there's no longer a taboo of any kind, certainly not one against cannibalism. From her perspective, meat is meat, and you're no more sacred than a rat. Now, do you want to debate whether the term zombie applies as if we're having tea in Cambridge?"
Jurgen's mouth has filled with saliva, as if he is about to vomit. He swallows hard, and swallows again. You saw what Ramsey Corrigan did to his parents, his brother, that homeland agent who was a martial arts specialist. What he did in seconds.
He's 17, bigger than an NFL linebacker. Minette is 34, 17 years older, less than half his weight. Just a damn girl, a gash, and she doesn't have the advantage of surprise like Ramsey Corrigan did. Are you going to help me get this done, or are you going to wimp out on me?
While Dubose turns away and climbs the porch steps, Carter Jurgen doesn't bother to catalog the advantages of wimping out, which are countless, but tries unsuccessfully to think of a single convincing benefit to manning up and accompanying his partner. Dubose reaches the porch. Dismayed, but not entirely surprised, Jurgen ascends the steps in his partner's wake. He is loath to admit to the truth of his own psychology, which is not reptilian, but which is certainly screwed up. As much as Radley Dubose frustrates, appalls, and disgusts him, Jurgen wants the big man's approval. Maybe that is because Jurgen's mother loves only her political and charitable causes, and because his father is remote, incapable of affection, and disapproving of everything short of perfection. Self-analysis was a key fascination of the perpetual juveniles with whom he matriculated at Harvard, but Jurgen, who found that practice puerile then, finds it no less so now. He doesn't know why anyone does anything, least of all himself. Dubose is an inbred backwoods rustic from a squalid family, poorly educated at Princeton, crude, often mannerless. But he is also an indomitable force, free of self-doubt, ruthless, brutal, in love with power and its many privileges, a confirmed elitist in spite of his origins, a rapist and murderer without any capacity for guilt or even regret, because he knows that the only natural law is the law of the blade and the gun, that conscience and virtue are fictions, merely inventions of those who wish to rule others by self-righteous moral intimidation. So there is much about him to admire. Perhaps Dubose is not an ideal surrogate big brother, but Jurgen follows him across the porch and, warily, into the house. Chapter 15. None of the officers at the roadblock wore a uniform, but a Homeland Security photo ID hung on a lanyard around the neck of the one seeking Bernie's attention. The Tiffin Allegro was equipped with a driver's door, optional on that model. Bernie put down the window and looked as solemn as his aging, Muppet face would allow.
Wow. Homeland Security. Must mean big trouble.
The agent had to peer up at him in the high driver's seat. The man had a gurnished face, an unfortunate nothing from brow to chin that you would remember for maybe 30 seconds after he turned away. He said,
"We're just seeking a fugitive, sir. No crisis. May I see your license?" "Got it ready. Thought you'd need it,"
Bernie said, passing the license through the open window. The agent scanned it with a device that resembled a small flashlight and returned it to him. Jane's document source in Reseda had digitally massaged the photo that Bernie emailed them, so that it still resembled him as much as the average DMV portrait resembled anyone, while altering certain features enough to ensure that photo recognition software would never match the picture on Albert Rudolph Neary's license with any photograph of Bernie Rigowitz. Returning the license to Bernie, the agent said,
"Mr. Neary, I am respectfully requesting your permission to have Homeland Security agents board your motorhome in order to search it. You have the right to refuse this request, whereupon I will ask you to please pull off the highway and wait while we seek a search warrant."
"No need for any of that, sir. Rudy Neary is as damn proud to be an American as anyone. Maybe more proud than most these days. Have a look. Have a look."
Two agents came aboard through the starboard side passenger door, the first one young and lean with buzz-cut hair and eyes like wet slate. He wasn't wearing a sport coat, and a pistol was ready in his belt holster.
Is anyone traveling with you, Mr. Neary?
Nope. Just lonesome me.
This will only take a couple minutes, he said as he moved into the living space behind the cockpit. Bernie thought,
Adoshem, Adoshem, make these men stupid and blind and careless.
He felt reasonably confident they wouldn't find Jane or Luther, or the weapons and other gear that were secreted in the hollow bases of the dinette booth benches. The second agent was older, his brown hair threaded with white, pure snow at the temples. He was about 20 pounds overweight, with a pleasant, rubbery face and an avuncular manner. No coat, another belt holster. He sighed wearily as he sat in the co-pilot's chair and smiled warmly enough to toast a slice of challah. The ID on his lanyard said he was Walter Hackett.
Quite a vehicle you have here, Mr. Neary. A real beauty. I dream about getting one of these when I finally hang up the shield. My son-in-law says it's too big for me. I guess he thinks the only thing just my size is either a lazy boy recliner or a coffin. My daughter married one of those,
Hackett commiserated.
What brings you to Borrego Springs, aside from escaping the son-in-law? I hope you won't arrest me when I tell you, but my wife's last wish was to have her ashes spread on the desert here, where all the wildflowers bloom in the spring. I'm pretty damn sure it breaks one crazy damn environmental law or another. Sorry to hear about your loss, but no reason to worry. I don't work for the EPA.
Hackett's eyes were the gray of iron with specks of rust.
You have them with you now, for ashes? Oh, no. That was 4 years ago. I just come back to visit on every wedding anniversary. She was a lucky woman, married to such a romantic. What was your wife's name?
Bernie made no effort to summon tears. They welled in him naturally at the thought of Miriam, even though he'd never spread her ashes here or anywhere.
Penelope. But nobody ever called her anything but Penny.
I lost my wife 9 years ago, said Hackett. But a divorce doesn't hurt as much, even when you never saw it coming.
Either way, it's hard, I think, said Bernie. It's a lonely world. Either way.
True enough. How long do you intend to stay here in the valley?
I'm booked 3 days at the RV park. But with all this here commotion, I'm nervous about staying. Grim Reaper's gonna get to me soon enough. Don't want some damn terrorist doing his job for him.
Relax, Mr. Neary. There's no terrorist threat here. Just a man on the run we need to find.
Chapter 16. Jane Hawk, casketed in the stifling dark, listening to muffled voices, footfalls on thinly carpeted floorboards, doors being opened and closed. The motorhome was convincingly staged. Bernie had brought 2 suitcases of clothes and had hung them in the closet, folded them in dresser drawers. He had laid out his toiletries in the bathroom. A couple of magazines and a book lay on his nightstand. Another book and 1/2 cup of cold coffee were on a side table next to the sofa in which Jane hid. He was an old man, traveling alone, and no detail had been overlooked that might betray her and Luther's presence. Yet the search seemed to be taking too long. Her arms were resting full length at her sides. When something crawled onto the back of her left hand, she twitched involuntarily to fling it off, and her hand bumped against the inner face of the front board of the sofa platform. The sound was soft, a muffled thump that surely couldn't be heard above the grumble of the idling engine. But the voices fell silent, as if in reaction to the noise she'd made. The crawling thing found her again. Its feelers, legs, and busy questing suggested that it must be a sizable cockroach that had come all the way from Nogales. She allowed it to explore her fingers, the back of her hand, her wrist. Chapter 17. Room by room, Here is an urgent prophecy of a post-Armageddon landscape, a future of mindless destruction and inescapable ruin, condensed into symbolic wreckage and presented like an elaborate installation by an artist driven mad by his vision. Ripped and tangled draperies torn down from bent rods, lovely paintings gouged and slashed in broken frames, as though beauty itself so offended the destroyers that they could not abide it. Upholstery slashed, entrails of stuffing spilling out of gutted furniture, deconstructed chairs. A large screen LED television unracked from the wall and cast down and hammered with a brass lamp, its electronic window to a world of wonders, now crazed like the blinded eye of a beaten corpse. Porcelain figurines beheaded and dismembered, likewise a collection of antique dolls violated with such apparent ferocity that Jurgen could only assume that those who rampaged here found the human form, in civilized depiction, an intolerable affront. Damp, yellowish arcs of urine sprayed across panels of wallpaper, books thrown down from shelves and urinated on, and in one open volume a deposit of feces. Glassware reduced to sparkling splinters, shattered plates and cups. In the demolished dining room, the half-naked remains of a ravaged man, the husband, hideously disfigured, his mouth gaping in a silent cry of havoc, genitals missing. Room by room, here is a vision of an apocalypse without revelation, without meaning, a scorched earth war of all against all, when time past will be obliterated, and neither will there be time future, only the perpetual storm of time present, the nights long and cold, the horror unremitting. Each with his pistol drawn, and in a firm two-hand grip, arms extended, Jurgen and Dubose proceed with utmost caution, without comment, quick and low through archways and doorways, every closet door a potential lid to a lethal jack-in-the-box. Jurgen is aware that the front sight of his weapon jumps on target, while Dubose's remains steady, but he can't settle his hands without stilling his heart, which booms as it never has from mere physical exertion. Failing to find Minette on the first floor, they ascend the stairs. The upper floor is untouched. No one has come here in thrall to a destructive fury. Although downstairs there were bloody prints of a woman's bare feet, there are none here. Nevertheless, they clear the rooms and attendant spaces one by one until they can say with certainty that she is gone. Lowering his pistol, Dubose says,
"She must have run straight through the house and out the back door before we even posted the deputies to watch for her."
"Gone where?"
"There's that resort and golf course not far from here. A lot of houses around it, but mostly just the desert."
Dubose uses his smartphone to call the Desert Flora Study Group and order the Airbus H-120 helicopter into the air. He wants it to conduct an ultra-low-altitude search. To hell with whether it puzzles and annoys the locals. Not just for a naked woman on foot, but also for signs of any outbreak of chaos related to the other 45 people who were brain-screwed the previous night. It's 45 rather than 49, because the four members of the Corrigan family are already dead. The term should be adjusted rather than brain-screwed, but in these circumstances, Jurgen would feel like an idiot if he corrected Dubose. Outside in the yard again, Radley Dubose conferences with deputies Utley and Parkwood, whose uniform shirts are stained with sweat. He explains that the woman escaped, that he and Jurgen will be searching for her, and that they should return to the sheriff's substation in Borrego Springs to await a visit by Homeland Security personnel, who will explain to them and their brethren the nature of the threat that has arisen on their turf.
"All I can tell you now," Dubose lies, "is maybe terrorists contaminated some local wells with a drug similar to, but far more powerful than, phencyclidine, which is called angel dust on the street, an animal tranquilizer. If you ever tried to subdue a PCP user, you know they're as crazy as shithouse rats, with the strength of 10. The crap these terrorists have brewed up makes angel dust seem as harmless as a
packet of Splenda.
Not for the first time, Carter Jurgen is amazed that Dubose can sell bullshit as if it were candy. His intimidating size, practiced solemnity, and Olympian confidence seem to mesmerize people, like these deputies, who should be able to see through his claptrap as easily as through a recently squeegeed window. Faces pale, eyes haunted, Utley and Parkwood buy the fake news and head back toward the black-and-white Dodge Charger parked along the county highway. The day is hotter than ever and bright enough to give Jurgen a headache, as if he's perpetually staring into a spotlight no matter where he looks. He needs a cold drink and two aspirin and a month at a fine southern resort hotel shaded by ancient magnolias, but he's only going to get two of the three. He says, "You better get some of our crew over to the sheriff's substation before the local cops start acting on your crazy story." Dubose holds up the smartphone in his hand.
"The line's been open to the Desert Flora guys."
He puts the phone to his face.
"You heard all that? Good. Corral the locals before they bring media down on us."
He terminates the call. "I'm a little surprised," says Jurgen, "that instead you didn't just shoot them, drag them in the house, and set the place on fire."
"It was an option, my friend. But Mrs. Atlee, sitting there in her Buick with the engine running, might have peeled out as Utley and Parkwood were going down before either of us could get to her."
En route to the Charger, Deputy Utley detours to have a word with Mrs. Atlee. When Utley gets in the patrol car and they head back toward Borrego Springs, Mrs. Atlee follows them.
"Good thing the Velociraptor has six-wheel drive,"
Dubose says as he moves toward the vehicle.
"We'll probably have to go off-road to find our zombie hottie."
There's a cooler behind the front seats, from which they take two cold cans of Red Bull. Without complaint, Jurgen climbs into the front passenger seat and shakes two aspirin from a bottle stowed in the console box. Dubose gets behind the steering wheel with the air of a king for whom the vehicle was expressly designed and built. As the big man puts on his sunglasses and starts the engine, Jurgen says,
"I half think you'd do her if you had the chance."
"Do who?"
"The zombie hottie, Minette Butterworth."
"The former Minette Butterworth,"
Dubose corrects.
"If I was sure I wouldn't have my package torn off like Lucky Bob, damn right I'd do her."
"No offense, but that's insane."
"It's not insane, my friend. I just have a more adventurous spirit than you have. As feral and fierce as the bitch is now, she'd be a unique experience, unforgettable, like every boy's best ever wet dream."
"Not every boy's," Jurgen demurs. As he drives slowly past the house, between the palm trees and toward the open land beyond, Dubose says,
"You know what I wish for you, cubby?"
"What's with the cubby?"
"It's a little private nickname I have for you."
"Yeah, well, keep it private. I don't like it."
"You will," Dubose assures him. "What I wish for you, cubby, is that one day you'll get past your uptight Boston Brahmin background and finally start to live, really live, unchained."
"I already live unchained," Jurgen says.
"The sad thing is that you think you do, but you're knotted up with inhibitions. You're 1,000 Gordian knots of inhibitions, repressed, suppressed, yearning after forbidden fruit, taboo-ridden, your emotions embargoed, your desires prescribed."
After a swig of Red Bull, Jurgen says, "I've committed every felony known to man. I've murdered people, all kinds of people, women as well as men. If I could get my hands on this hawk brat, this Travis kid, I'd kill him too."
"Yes," Dubose acknowledges. "But not with verve, cubby. Not with the pure delight and the conviction of righteousness that comes with the total inner freedom of a true revolutionary. That's what I wish for you. Total inner freedom."
In spite of himself, Jurgen is moved by his partner's concern, though he's not prepared to admit it.
That's you, is it? He asks. Total inner freedom?
Total.
How long did it take you to get this total inner freedom?
I think I was 7 years old, Bradley DeBose says. Though maybe six.
Chapter 18. The voices fell silent. Jane heard the distinctive sound of the vehicle's front door slamming shut. After a moment, the motorhome began to move again, slowly at first, but then accelerating. She pressed the interior latch release and slid open the seat of the sofa, admitting light to her hiding place. As she rose into a crouch, Bernie called back to her from the driver's seat.
I'm so smooth at this, I could make a fool of a lie detector. Kynine Hora.
From her previous road trip with him, she knew that Kynine Hora was sort of like knock wood, words meant to ward off the evil eye. She stepped over the slab of particle board to which the sofa cushions were glued, and she stood considering the cockroach. It had crawled under the sleeve of her sport coat, up her bare arm, under the sleeve of her t-shirt, into her armpit, between her breasts. Sliding a hand into the left cup of her bra, she captured the bug and withdrew it. The creature twitched and quivered against the palm of her closed hand. Although she could easily have crushed it, she did not. She thought of Ivan Petro, the man she had killed 2 days ago in self-defense, in an oak grove north of Los Angeles, and thinking of him brought back to her the faces of others. The cockroach was a pest, a feeder on filth and a carrier of disease, but it wasn't a mortal threat to her. If she respected this humble creature, perhaps she would be able to reach Travis and convey him to a safe place, Kynine Hora. She opened her hand and dropped the insect into the hollow under the sofa, watched it scurry into a corner of that space, and slid shut the trick seat. As Jane crossed to the kitchen sink to wash her hands, Luther Tillman stepped out of the door to the master bedroom at the back of the motorhome.
So, we're in,
he said as he moved forward, swaying slightly with the motion of the moving vehicle. We're in, she said. Next stop, the RV park. Chapter 19. Hot light falling good on your skin, soft earth warm underfoot, running, running. Don't know where, don't know why, just free and running, running, running. Trees, shade, stop in shade, drop to your knees, kneel, panting in shade, sweating and panting. Wound in your hand, not bleeding much, lick carefully. Warmth between your legs reminds you of male, shiver with thrill of his agony, how he broke, how he bled. Thirst, mouth dry, throat raw. No smell of water here. Find water. Food. But where? Overhead, things unseen flutter in trees, alive and fluttering, sheltering from heat. Your thirst and hunger breed fear. Fear makes thirst greater, hunger sharper. Fear feeds fear. Fluttering in trees suddenly seems sinister. No more voice in your head, but something crawling inside your head. Crawling, crawling, flickers of lightning inside your head, bright lines of tattered webbing. Fear of things unseen, fear of aloneness, fear of being alone with things unseen. Running again, urgently, urgently, out of trees, harder earth, grass whipping your legs, pricking, stinging. Hot light falling burns now, burns the skin, stings the eyes, earth hurts underfoot, pain. Pain sharpens fear, breeds desperation. Shapes ahead. Shapes blue like the blue above where light falls from. Different trees. Shade, but less shade from different trees. A blue place in the shade. Alone. Thirst. Hunger. Confusion. Who am I? What am I? Where am I? Why? Danger. 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 Alone. Hide. In the big blue shape, a tall white shape with clear shapes. Words come and go, familiar, but only half understood. Door and windows. You look through. A place beyond. Shaded place out of falling, burning light. Water place? Food place? Safe place for hiding? Something there that needs killing? Crawling inside your head. Crawling things seeking one another. Stone. Means what? Stone. Means nothing. Nothing. Again into hot falling light. Urgent. Urgent. Looking for something. What? Rock. Yes. This. This rock. Clear shape window breaks. Reach through. Find thing that turns. Door thing opens, closes. Hot inside, but shade everywhere. Listen. Listen. Any sound a threat? Silence a threat? Sound and silence both feed fear. Fear fuels more fear. Smell water. A drop falls from shiny curve, falls into white hollow space. Another drop. Another. Fumble with shiny things. One turns. Water comes. You drink. Cool. Wet. Good. Make water stop. Moving through shaded spaces. Threat at every turn. Unbearable threat. Unbearable. Sit in a corner. Back to the corner. Shaded spaces in front. Listening. Wondering. Fearing. Threatened. And alone. Fear breeds anger, breeds rage. Bright, broken web threads glimmering inside your head. Crawling things seeking inside your head. Crawling and faintly whispering far away. Many threatening whispers far away. Icy fear. Blistering rage. You shake with both. No cure for fear except rage, and rage seething into fury. Threatening whispers beget enraged whispering of your own. You whisper a challenge, an invitation to come here, come find you, come be killed. Kill or be killed. Come to the different trees, the blue place. Kill. Kill. Kill.
Chapter 20. Cornell Jasperson knows more about dogs now than he did a few days earlier, and one thing he knows is that they don't necessarily pee a lot, but they pee to a pretty rigid schedule. The last time Cornell took Duke and Queenie out to pee, first thing that morning, the sound of a low-flying twin-engine airplane in this usually quiet valley had for some reason triggered an intense anxiety attack, from which he had needed hours to fully recover. He didn't want to take the dogs out again, because maybe the plane was still up there. If he had another anxiety attack, it might be even worse than the first one. Maybe he would collapse outside and be unable to get back into his library, leaving the boy alone and frightened. When he collapsed, maybe he would lose control of the dogs and never see them again, and have to tell the heartbroken boy that the dogs had run away, and the boy would hate him, and would never eat sandwiches with him again, and would never ask him to read aloud again. So then Cornell would have to live alone like before, which was what he had always thought he preferred until recently. Although he didn't want to risk walking the dogs insisted on being walked. There was no getting out of it. He wouldn't take them without leashes, as he had done before, just in case the unusual airplane was passing inexplicably low and the imaginary ants started crawling all over him and he had to get inside quickly. The boy clipped the leashes to their collars so that Cornell wouldn't have to chance the dogs touching his bare skin.
I could take them out, the boy said.
No, you're a lot safer here. I'll be back soon. I'll make a new kind of sandwich, little bags of potato chips. Good muffins for dessert.
Sandwiches with sweet pickles on the side? The boy asked.
Yes, precisely. And cola, canned under the authority of the Coca-Cola Company, Atlanta, Georgia, 30313,
by a member of the Coca-Cola Bottlers Association, Atlanta, Georgia. 30327. The boy laughed softly.
I like you.
I like me, too, though I'm a walking nut bar. And I like you, Travis Hawk.
Cornell let the dogs take him outside, and he held the leashes tightly while they smelled the ground and the weeds and each other, and then more ground and weeds, before taking turns peeing. The day was too hot and too bright, everything flat in the hard light. Quiet. At the moment, no airplane was growling through the sky immediately overhead. But then, the scream shrilled through the day. He had never heard anything like it. Maybe the dogs hadn't heard anything like it either, because they raised their heads and pricked their ears and stood very still. The scream came again, a little muffled, half like a person screaming and half like an animal. The first time, the screamer had sounded miserable and frightened, but the second time there was rage in the cry, too, a scary ferocity. It seemed to come from the little blue house in which Cornell had lived while building his library for the end of the world. The dogs were focused on the house, and they started to pull Cornell toward it. He struggled to hold them back. When the third scream cleaved the day, it was so chilling that the dogs changed their minds about wanting to investigate the source. Cornell wasn't seized by anxiety. He cautioned himself not to be his worst self, to be his better and calmer self. Not that he always listened to himself at times like this, though sometimes he did. He turned the dogs away from the house and walked them back to the barn that wasn't a barn. No further screams issued from the little blue house during the time that Cornell took to get into his library and get out of the too hot, too bright day, which had suddenly become also too strange. Cornell had been expecting the boy's mother to come today, and he had been hoping she would not get here until late, until after lunch and reading aloud time, maybe not until after dinner. But now he wished she were here already. Chapter 21. Torrential, wind-driven rain rushes in from the Gulf of Mexico, as if that entire body of water will be drawn into the Thunderheads and purified of its salt and thrown down onto the lowlands of Texas in some dire judgment that will require an enormous ark and animals boarded two by two. Egon Gottfrey in the Rhino GX, westbound from Beaumont to Houston, powers through flooded swales in the pavement, the tires casting up dark wings of dirty water. The wipers can't always cope with the downpour. Frequently, the windshield presents the world as cataracted eyes might see it, misty, bleary, the buildings distorted into the grotesque structures of some alternate universe. Nevertheless, Gottfrey drives fast, exceeding the posted limits, not in the least concerned about a collision, considering that the traffic with which he shares the road is as much an illusion as is the highway itself. Anyway, he can see clearly what he most needs to see, the truth of the conspiracy that misled him, who helped Ansel and Claire Hawk, and where Jane's in-laws have taken refuge. He has a long drive ahead of him, especially in this weather, but triumph awaits him at the end. Maybe he will get to Ansel and Claire too late to wrench from them young Travis's location while it still matters, but it will never be too late to inject and enslave them. Part 5. Plain Jane. Chapter 1. Most of the long-existing campgrounds in Borrego Valley were open in season only, and not all were motorhome-friendly. A new facility, Hammersmith Family RV Park, had booked the Tiffin Allegro by phone with the promise of a 3-day cash deposit on arrival. The white Chevy Suburban, which the motorhome was towing, had to be unhitched and left in a lot immediately outside the campground prior to check-in, because the spaces allotted to RVs weren't large enough to accommodate additional vehicles. In that blacktop parking lot, where thermals rising off the pavement smelled faintly of tar. Jane and Luther transferred their weapons and other gear from the Tiffin Allegro to the Suburban. Bernie hadn't slept well since getting Jane's call on Monday, not because he feared for himself, and not just because he feared that she would be killed. He also dreaded that he might even see her being killed, whereupon he would be so emptied of all hope for this world that he might curse Adonai, the sacred name of God, which was never a good idea. He said, "The longer I don't get a call from you, the more I'm going meshuggah." "You'll be fine," she said. "You always are."
"You take care of each other."
"That's the plan," Luther said, as he climbed in the driver's seat of the Suburban, pulled the door shut, started the engine. Jane said, "Did you put it on? You don't look like you did."
"It's silly. I'm not in the action. But I'll put it on."
"There's nothing silly about it. These bastards have quietly locked down this valley. Before we're out of here, it might be something worse than a street fight. It might even be more intimate than that, the equivalent of a cage fight."
"I'll wear it already. But it's heavy."
"It's not heavy. It's level 2, not level 4. Not hard plates of Dyneema polyethylene or ceramic like on a battlefield. It's fine weave chainmail and Kevlar, very light. Light enough. Under a roomy Hawaiian shirt, nobody knows. And you promised me."
"So I'll wear it. Now make like a real granddaughter and give me a hug."
Hugging him, she said, "You better wear it."
"You're such a nudge. A promise is a promise with me."
"If I don't call in 2 hours, be ready to split. If I don't call in 2 and a half, get the hell out of here." Bernie felt a tightness in his chest, as if he might have a cardiac episode, which he wouldn't because he had no heart problems, and because this wasn't the time or place for a responsible person to drop dead.
"It's not like I spent my life abandoning people, so why should you think it'll be easy for me?"
"You won't be abandoning anyone," she assured him. "If I don't call, we'll be dead."
"It won't turn out that way. You'll get your boy."
She didn't smile when she said, "Your lips to God's ear." As she got into the Suburban, Bernie said,
"Don't forget."
She looked back at him.
"Always and forever. Mishpucha."
"Mishpucha," she said, letting the "ch" rattle against the roof of her mouth just right. She pulled the door shut, and Luther drove the Suburban out of the parking lot. Bernie Rigowitz, being Albert Rudolph Neary, checked into the Hammersmith Family RV Park. They assigned him to a nice, quiet space near the back of the campground. He hooked up only to their electric service. With the air conditioning full blast, he sat in the co-pilot's chair and sipped from a cold can of 7-Up and took an acid-reducing pill and stared through the windshield. There were palm trees so recently planted and fresh that they didn't look the least bit sun-withered. There was a big swimming pool with a wide deck around it. There were lounge chairs on the deck for people who wanted to tan. There were big red umbrellas shielding tables where you could play cards or whatever. The water in the pool was pale blue, with a reflection of the sky, and rippled with silver reflections of the sun. Everything was very pretty. The scene turned his stomach, as if he'd eaten a pound or two of the sweetest prune jam hamantash anyone had ever baked. He knew he shouldn't take a second acid-reducing pill. He chewed a pair of Tums instead. He didn't know why all this prettiness should sicken him. Okay, not true. He knew why, all right. Much as he tried not to be negative, he couldn't help but think that the afternoon might not turn out pretty in the end. Chapter 2. Henry Lorimar and his partner, Nelson Luft, neighbors of Robert and Minette Butterworth, had been helping authorities in the search for the kidnapped little boy when the obscene ranting had begun. For a moment, Henry thought it came from the sound system of their Lexus SUV, which he was driving, but then somehow he understood that it issued instead from deep inside his head. He was briefly frightened by this realization, until a still, small voice assured him this was the new normal, that all was well, that he should accept and move on with his work. This was nothing more than the Whispering Room, a high-tech communications system that linked the civilian volunteers who were searching for the missing child. Yes, whoever the ranting person might be, he was misusing the technology, but this was just the Whispering Room, one of the many advantages of the new normal. Evidently, Nelson received the ferocious rant at greater volume or on a more penetrating wavelength than did Henry. While the rapid gush of vicious obscenities was offensive and distracting to Henry, it proved at once painful to Nelson and soon became excruciating. Within the safety harness that secured him to the front passenger seat, Nelson writhed in torment, his hands alternately clamped to his head or pounding on the door, on the window, as though he was desperate to escape, but had forgotten how to get out of the vehicle. Each time fear rose in Henry Lorimar, a voice separate from that of the ranter counseled him to remain calm. There was nothing to be concerned about. If he just did what was expected of him, if he searched for the missing boy according to his instructions, all would be well. He would be happy, content, at peace. Nevertheless, unable to concentrate on his driving, he pulled off the road, shifted into park, engaged the emergency brake. He left the engine running to maintain the air conditioning. The one voice ranted, loud and increasingly animalistic, but the other voice spoke so softly that it wasn't a voice as much as it was like a conscience. An inner source of moral guidance telling him that he needed to do what he had been tasked to do, that if he did the right thing, he would be happy, content, and at peace. This conscience-like counselor was authoritative, irresistible, therefore not at all like a conscience, which could be ignored, but more like a controller. Yet as much as Henry wanted to obey, he remained paralyzed because the louder voice bored into him, tore at him, though in a strangely thrilling way, drilling down until it struck nerves in him that didn't flash with pain when touched, but instead flared with pleasure, desires so deeply buried and so beyond his experience that he didn't have words to describe them. For a while, the outer world did not press upon his senses, and he lived entirely in his head, in the assault of words and wordless cries counterpointed by the quiet but insistent instruction of his controller. Soon, the ranter's vocal transmissions were accompanied by fierce emotions, hatred, fury, lust, so scalding that they seemed to peel away layers of Henry's identity, as superheated steam might peel away skin. With the sounds and emotions came images of extreme violence that seemed beautiful to him, and sexual congress so intense that, in its way, it was another kind of violence. At one point, Henry Lorimar became aware of the sound of the idling car engine, the cold air blowing from the dashboard vents, and the stink of human waste. The last of those sensations turned his head to the right, where his partner, Nelson Luft, no longer writhed in agony. White-faced and frail, Nelson slumped in his safety harness, head turned toward Henry, mouth agape, blood dripping from the cups of his ears. He had soiled himself. He was alive, softly inhaling and exhaling, his gaze moving slowly over the interior of the Lexus, as if everything on which his eyes alighted was mysterious to him. When he met Henry's stare, Nelson appeared not to recognize his partner of 15 years, regarding him with the same puzzlement inspired by the steering wheel, the radio, and the cup holders in the console. Cold horror and grief iced Henry's heart, and he began to surface from the thrall of the hateful rant. But the conscience that was not a conscience pressed him to put the Lexus in gear and get on with the search for the kidnapped boy, as he had agreed to do, as he had been instructed. Everything else meant nothing. Nelson Luft meant nothing. Nelson could be dealt with later. Nelson could wait. Nelson would be fine. Henry needed only to do what he had been told to do, what urgently needed to be done, and then he would be very happy, content, and at peace. As horror and grief melted out of him, however, Henry didn't release the emergency brake or put the car in gear. Like the sea to the moon, he succumbed to the tidal pull of the rant. The interior of the Lexus faded from his awareness as the exquisite images of violence and thrilling fornication flooded in upon him, accompanied by raw emotions and the tsunami of words that darkled his mind. How much time passed, Henry could not say, but eventually the ranter stopped transmitting. Gradually, Henry became aware of the vehicle in which he sat, although at first he could not identify it or recall its purpose. The whispering room was quiet, no communications incoming. But another strange sound in his head troubled him, sputtering, sizzling, subtle but persistent. When his eyes were closed, he could see, or perhaps he imagined, a darkness in his head across which the radials and spirals of a web pulsed irregularly with light, as if a current of varying power coursed through those filaments. Degree by degree, knowledge and functionality returned to him. He sat up straighter. He adjusted his shirt collar. He remembered the remaining places he and Nelson needed to visit in their low-key search for the kidnapped boy, and he realized that he had better get on with the task. In the passenger seat, Nelson Luft no longer breathed. His stare was as fixed as that of a mannequin. Blood had stopped seeping from his ears. This was nothing to be concerned about. Nothing important. Nothing that mattered at all. Nelson could be dealt with later. The important thing was to get on with the urgent hunt for the missing and endangered boy. It was misguided and selfish to think that anything mattered other than finding the boy. The vehicle reeked of feces, but that was a mere inconvenience. Henry could get used to it. He was already getting used to it. Soon, he wouldn't smell it at all. He released the emergency brake and put the Lexus in gear and drove back onto the highway. He could drive, but he wasn't at ease behind the wheel like he'd been before. Everything seemed unfamiliar to him, almost as if he were a young teenager again, just learning to handle a motor vehicle. Something had changed in him. He couldn't focus on what he was doing as well as he once had. His mind kept drifting. Fear without cause came and went, as did sharp spasms of anger. Dramatic images of violence and brutal sex, none from Henry's personal experience, quivered through his mind as vividly as if they were things that he had done. He'd driven only a mile, when a new voice rose in the whispering room. This one, female, simultaneously furious and frightened, ridden by hungers she could name and others for which she knew no words. She transmitted incoherent chains of words, hatred and desire, a threat and a challenge. Images, too. A blue stucco house with a white metal roof, shaded by shabby palm trees. She wanted sex and blood, wanted to quell her fear by instilling terror in others. Wanted the thrill of exercising her power and inflicting pain, wanted to scream into the void that she sensed yawning beneath her, and